Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's December 2022, and this is episode 319, which is a conversation about church history and Polycarp, the Bishop of Smyrna, who lived from AD 69 to 155. Today's guest is Dr. Louis Marcos. He holds the Robert H. Ray Chair in Humanities at Houston Christian University. He's also the author of more than 22 books, including his book, From Plato to Christ, How Platonic Thought Shaped the Christian Faith. Lou has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called The Martyrdom of Polycarp. Our subscribers can read his article for free at our website, equip.org, because every subscription comes with the online access to exclusive articles. If you don't already subscribe, you can also head on over to equip.org and subscribe for $33.50. Lou, it's good to have you on again.
It's great to be back, Melanie.
Well, I'm sure some of our listeners are wondering, who is Polycarp? And why would I even care about this? And I just want to say that at my church, I recently went through a Sunday school class that was about 10 weeks through some really interesting figures in church history way back at the very early church, and we ended up around the 300s. And it's interesting because I probably thought before, who's ever heard of these people? Why would I care? And as their lives were unfolded for me, I realized how important they were in church history for the Christian and why we should care about them now, because a lot of the issues that they faced, surprisingly, we still face. And so a lot of times we don't interact with history that much. I think history to us is like maybe the last, 10 years or something. And these days, when we think of the internet, it's like things are old after, a week or something. So I think this is a very interesting topic and conversation we're going to have today. So first of all, before we talk about Polycarp, who is the main topic, I want to ask you about Eusebius and his role in ecclesiastical history. And why do some historians actually doubt the reliability of who he was? And why do you consider him reliable? And how is he even related to our conversation about Polycarp?
And luckily, Eusebius is the great historian of the early church. The early church means from Acts to Constantine, who is the one who ended the persecution against the church. So about 300 years. And Eusebius is a contemporary of Constantine, so the 4th century AD. And we are just so lucky because he not only gives us the history of the church, he gives us the history of the Bible, who wrote the books of the Bible. He tells us all of these things. And he includes in his ecclesiastical history, means history of the church, right? Ecclesiastic church. And in it, he includes the martyrdom of Polycarp. Now, the reason why a lot of modern historians are a little bit doubtful, a little bit cynical, is that Eusebius actually knew Saint Constantine. Well, he's a saint in the Orthodox Church. He knew Constantine, and he saw him as a great liberator. And indeed, Constantine is the one who ended the terrible persecution against the church. But Melanie, there are a lot of people today that want to look upon Constantine as the enemy, right? Because he institutionalized the church. And there is some truth to that. I'm not going to doubt that. But Constantine did stop the persecution and help the church to grow. He called for the Council of Nicaea to establish and firmly establish the doctrines of the church. He's a very important figure, but a lot of people are sort of suspicious of him, and therefore they think, well, Eusebius is biased because he likes Constantine, and so he's going to airbrush history. But actually, if you sit down and read the ecclesiastical history, part of it is the narrative that Eusebius is telling, but a lot of it is primary documents. Eusebius is so helpful because he collects together bits and pieces of Jewish historians and pagan historians, the Edict of Milan, which ended the persecution. We've actually got it there. We have a lot of the affidavits that the emperors put out when they were persecuting the church. And when we can find those documents in other places, they match up with Eusebius. So a lot of what he's doing is preserving primary documents and then sort of knitting them together and commenting and whatnot. So I do think that we can, we have to stop this. Oh, it's propaganda. We can't trust this guy. He does a very good job. Also, just like the Gospels, Melanie, he often makes the Christians look bad. In fact, the last and worst persecution that was the persecution that finally Constantine ended. It was called the Diocletian persecution. He actually partially blames the church for getting too fat and too comfortable and too materialistic. So he doesn't make the Christians always wonderful and the Romans always evil. We get a fairly even-handed view of history. So I think a lot of what he gives us is reliable and gives us a window into the early church.
This is kind of interesting. You mentioned Diocletian, and that is, our listeners will know, just a few weeks ago, we released a podcast about St. Nicholas and Santa, and we do talk about St. Lucia, and also known as St. Lucy, and she was martyred under Diocletian. But also to go back to Constantine, I don't know if our listeners would know this, is that he was just a very interesting person, and while he was his mother was a Christian and his dad was a pagan, there was really just interest. And also, he never was catechized in the church, but he encouraged the building of churches. And he was just a really central figure. And so why would we, you mentioned the calling of the Council of Nicaea by him. And why would people even care about that? Well, I also want to point our listeners, if you missed the episode on spiritual friendship, which is something that is going on big in the evangelical church today, guess what? The church fathers answered some of those issues way back in the 300s. So all of the stuff that we're going to talk about today, you really should think about it and look into it. Read Lou's book. It's very important in the history of the church because, frankly, it's still relevant to us today.
It is incredibly important, Melanie, because if we don't know that, we end up fighting the same arguments against heresy over and over again. The Council of Nicaea did not invent orthodoxy. It cemented it and gave a philosophical language to help cement what the early church fathers already believed for the last 300 years. That's one of the reasons I wrote my book, to document all of the it's there, the incarnation, the resurrection, everything is taught clearly. But because of the heretics, and that's what Eusebius is telling us about the heretics, because of them, we had to adopt a more philosophical and sort of specific kind of language to preserve and protect the doctrine that had been believed for 300 years. And maybe we could talk more about that with Eusebius, Melanie.
Yes, I mean, I think that's so important what you're saying, because believe it or not, you know, people are still asking, who is Jesus? And all of these things that were documented way back then in these councils where they debated the nature of Christ. It sounds very, you know, tedious, but it really wasn't. And that is so important to us to, like you say, preserve the truth of Christianity. So let's go back to Eusebius. You were talking about why he's important. And what did he have to say in his book specifically about heresy and also apostolic succession? And why were those two particular subjects important to him in particular?
See, especially if you're an evangelical like myself, we have this idea that there's the early church, by which we mean the church of Acts and the letters of Paul, and then everybody goes to sleep for 1,500 years, okay? You know, the church, after the apostles died, after all the people that knew Jesus in the flesh died, how do you hold everything together? Well, there were three ways of doing it. One, of course, was the Bible. The canon of scripture is vital, and Eusebius talks about how it was put together and why they think this person wrote it. It's very important. But there were two other ways they did it. Another one was by the creeds. I believe in one God, Father, that's the Nicene Creed. But there have been creeds all along that we need to know and memorize. But the third thing, and this is very, very important, particularly for Catholic and Orthodox believers, is what's called apostolic succession. And it almost seems, you know, tedious to us, but Eusebius gives us these long lists of bishops, and that most of them are unbroken lists from the beginning. The Bishop of Rome, Jerusalem, Antioch, Smyrna, Ephesus, Alexandria, all the major sites of Christianity, because it was through this apostolic succession, one bishop leading down to the next, that the orthodoxy of the church was preserved. And we need to understand how important this is. We almost sort of take it for granted today. We need those. We've got the Bible. And I'm an evangelical. I'm okay with sola scriptura, but I'm also not okay with it. We need the creeds to cement what we believe. And the apostolic succession is what gives legitimacy to that. And it's just like when you read the genealogies in the Old Testament, right? We have a knowledge of how this was passed down, and it's absolutely essential. And if we don't know this, we're going to start having people doubting the very way that the word tradition, Melanie, means to hand down, traditio. How was the tradition hand down? Through the creeds, through the councils, but also through the apostolic succession. And another reason why a lot of people don't like Eusebius today is because he's a heresy hunter. He shows us the dangers of heresies that either denied the deity of Christ or, oddly enough, denied the humanity of Christ. And so he shows in his book the great church fathers who fought for orthodoxy, like St. Nicholas, right? Who fought against the heretics to preserve our faith. And that's why people don't like the book, but that's why the book is so important, because heresy, if we allow it to come in, then we no longer have a true gospel, because we no longer have a true Christ.
You know, it's really interesting that a lot of probably evangelicals, less so certain traditions, Protestant traditions like Lutheranism or Anglicanism, but the vast swath of what people think are quote-unquote Christians in America tend to be just like pop culture evangelicals. And you're so right. They think, okay, it's the book of Acts and then the Reformation. And what people don't realize is, and I learned this in my church history class at my Protestant church just recently, is that basically, you know, before the church split into East and West, especially during the time of the Council of Nicaea and Constantine, like you're talking about, when they all met, when the bishops met at that time, I think there were more than 1,000 bishops throughout the East and the West, but it was mostly the Eastern bishops that met, and there were only a few hundred of them that met, that debated all these things. So I don't think that a lot of Christians realize when they say the creeds, it wasn't people from the Western Church. It was the Eastern bishops, primarily from North Africa and also from what we now know as Libya at the time. So these are really important facts that people should think about, because I think a lot of times we think about Christendom and again, we think it's the book of Acts and then suddenly it's the, you know, modern church and we're singing praise and worship music. There's so much more to church history.
And again, I am an evangelical. I understand this, but the Bible is not always self-explicating, okay? We need the creeds and we need the councils to keep us centered, right? If we don't have that, we go astray into every kind of heresy. So these people are vital. And yes, we need to know more about them. And they're exciting too, as we'll see, Melanie.
Well, one thing Eusebius also covered in his work was people who were martyrs. So how did he, you know, kind of portray them, and how did he kind of portray them as a new kind of hero?
See, we kind of take this for granted because we've heard of martyrs for 2,000 years. But before, you know, the early church, the heroes that we see, not only in something like, Homer or Virgil, but in historians like Plutarch or Livy or any of these historians, these are the great heroes that have courage. They go out and fight, and sometimes they die, but they're powerful and they never bow their head to anything. They're like Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar. All of a sudden, we have an absolutely new kind of hero that the world has never seen before. Martyrs who have all the courage and endurance of an Alexander or a Julius Caesar, and yet this utter humility, this complete obedience to Christ, that they are willing to lay down their life for him. Martyr is a Greek word that means witness. And we use the word martyr because they give the ultimate witness, which is their own life. Now, Melanie, when I started doing the research for my book, one of the things I was shocked to find is up until Constantine, there is no evidence of the Christians ever fighting back, by which I mean taking up arms and attacking or killing people. Everything they did was passive resistance. Think of Gandhi or think of Martin Luther King in our country. they fought and they put down their blood, but there was never a resistance. And the other thing I found out that was very humbling, Melanie, very convicting, is they took the Sermon on the Mount unbelievably literally. I mean, they turned the other cheek. When you read the early stuff, they're always quoting and they're always trying to live out. Now, I just have to throw something in here because this is another thing they throw at Constantine. It is absolutely true that the early church people never fought back. But after Constantine, we have this just war theory and we have Christians going to war. That's an easy way to attack Constantine. But we need to understand something, okay? Before Constantine, it was easy for the church to be martyrs and to always practice passive resistance because they had those nice Roman pagans fighting the barbarians and saving their lives. Once we became the leaders, we had to realize it was now our job to protect the world from barbarians who would destroy everything. Now, I'm not going to argue just theory or how much it's true or not, but we can't blame Constantine and say, oh, all of a sudden, these Christians are soldiers. Well, now the Christians are in charge, and we need to figure out what to do. The Dark Ages was not caused by the church. The Dark Ages were caused when the Roman Empire fell, the soldiers were gone, the barbarians came and killed, raped, pillaged everything. And it was only once the church got strong enough to defend itself that we move out of the Dark Ages into the High Middle Ages. So I don't want to sound like in a soapbox, but we need to understand. But still, as individuals, okay, not as people in charge of saving others, as individuals, if we follow the early church and follow the Sermon on the Mount, it should be a kind of passive resistance and a willingness to even suffer to follow Christ.
Some of you might be thinking, I have been waiting on getting all my Christmas wish list fulfilled for all those friends and family and people I'm getting gifts for. And so it's too late to get a lot of things shipped to you. But it's not too late to give a gift subscription to the Christian Research Journal because you can just email somebody the link to our website and show them all the great articles that they will be receiving that they can see for free already. But also that the fact that they're going to get online exclusive access to some of our articles that we have as online exclusives, plus the print edition to their door. And so it's a great gift for those last minute gift givers to friends, family, or even maybe your pastor or people on your pastoral staff like youth workers or discipleship coordinators for your church. And also you might want to give yourself a gift because a lot of us receive money for Christmas gifts because people are stumped and they don't know what to get for us. And so this is a fun way that you can subscribe to the Christian Research Journal with that Christmas money and use things that you wouldn't normally have in your budget because you have this extra money that you've received as a gift for Christmas time. So I just want to wish you Merry Christmas on behalf of the Christian Research Journal editorial staff and ask you if you would like to give us a gift. The best gift that you can give us is help us out with the algorithm online. Would you go on over to Apple Podcasts and just take a few minutes of your time and tell people why you like listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast? Because the more ratings and reviews that we receive, the more the algorithm thinks this is an interesting podcast. I think people would be interested in it. So that's really the biggest gift that you can give for us is just to tell friends about the podcast and link up some of your favorite episodes on your social media accounts and give us a rating and review. And Merry Christmas to you. Well, now I actually want to move on to the person of Polycarp. And so who was he? And also he had some prophetic dreams. And so did he in particular, speaking of, you know, what we were talking about, Eusebius and talking about martyrs, did he have a martyr complex? Did he consider that's where he was headed?
Let's talk about Polycarp, whose name means much fruit, and he did indeed bear much fruit. Polycarp was the bishop of Smyrna. Today that's called Izmir in Turkey. And he, when he was martyred, he was at least 86 years old. He probably was martyred in between 150 and 160 AD. He actually knew the Apostle John, right? Because we know that the Apostle John lived a long time. He's in his 90s when he's writing the book of Revelation, when he's exiled Patmos, the island of Patmos. So he is, in a sense, our last connection with one of the apostles who actually knew Christ. So he's a very important figure. He was also very, very close friends with Ignatius of Antioch. He was the bishop of Antioch. He was also martyred. And we have letters not only from Ignatius to the church, but we have one letter between Ignatius and Polycarp. So we know quite a bit about this man, an amazing person. Now, he had, okay, this idea of a martyr complex is the idea that they want to die to get glory. All right, if you read the early accounts, it was very clear with the church that if you could flee and run away, then you should. You don't willingly go and die. But if you are captured, you give your witness, you do not deny Christ, and that may mean martyrdom. Okay, so, but they were told, you don't just sit there and wait. And Polycarp did try to run away at first, but he was captured. And also, he had a prophetic dream where he was sleeping on a pillow that was on fire, a flaming pillow. And he realized that this was a message from the Holy Spirit about his martyrdom. And after he knew that he was called, he just relaxed and was absolutely obedient to God and went through with the martyrdom. So he did die, but he did not have what we would call a martyr complex today. He just knew that this is what he was called to. And I should just mention one thing, so I won't forget. One of the things I learned when I read these early martyrdom accounts is it was clear to all of them that their real enemy was not Rome. Their real enemy was Satan. They understood that this was spiritual warfare. And it's one of the reasons why they were able to forgive the Romans even as they were being martyred, because they understood that this was spiritual warfare. And that's right there from the beginning, Melanie.
So you mentioned that Polycarp was a bishop, and that is a high office in the church at that time. And two things I like to say about your comments. And one is, a lot of people doubt the existence of Jesus, that he even lived as a historical person. But here is somebody who was discipled by somebody who knew Jesus. So that's another historical fact that we can put out there, that, you know, Jesus existed.
That's true. That's true. We need to understand, again, that apostolic succession is important. There is a hand. And also, please, Melanie, I'm so tired of these people who deny the oral tradition because they say, did you ever play the game of telephone? Well, I've played the game of telephone and it was never as insane. People just have this weird mental block. Oh, that's the telephone game. We can't look, back then the oral tradition was incredibly complex and worked out, and those people had memories. Okay, we have to stop thinking about ourselves who have an attention span of 30 seconds and stop this childish thing of reminding us of telephone. The oral tradition, they kept very carefully records of what they were doing, and they honored their ancestors in a way that we've forgotten how. So it is reliable.
Well, I was mentioning that you had said that Polycarp was a bishop, and that is a higher office in the church and at the time. So how did he even get to be at that office? How was his ascent into leadership of the church? Where did he begin?
Again, you would begin sort of as a priest. Sometimes you might even begin as a deacon, as a priest. And the church knew who these saintly and holy people were. Of course, they were people that were educated and knew the scriptures. And they were chosen, right? They didn't like take over by fiat or something. The church recognized who these holy people were and raised them up to bishops, right? And generally speaking, just like in the Greek Orthodox Church today, whereas the priests might be married, the bishops were almost always celibate because, you know, their whole life was dedicated to the church. And the bishop was somebody that was over a bigger city or a bigger area. So they would be over, right? And in the beginning, the Pope was the Bishop of Rome, right? And he was considered the first among equals. And this is one of the splits between East and West. The East still considers the Pope to be the Bishop of Rome and even the first among equals, but not absolutely above everybody else, right? But what I'm saying is this is not some kind of totalitarian takeover of bishops. They are rising up from the church and recognized as leaders called by God.
So later in his life, of course, he's a bishop and he is, you know, in this position of authority. And there is a time that the governor is trying to try him and guards come to arrest him. And that's one thing that is very fascinating about this time period that I want to tell our listeners about, is because the church at that time, especially under once Constantine came to power, is that the bishops, you know, it was a religious position, but it was also political because of the fact that it was tied to the government. And so a lot of these guys got deposed, and then they got reinstated, and then they got deposed again, or they were on the run from the government. And so what was happening in Polycarp's situation with this, you know, people coming from the government to try to arrest him?
Okay, what happened back then, Melanie, and in the second century, we actually had some fairly good emperors, people like Trajan and Hadrian and Marcus Aurelius. Many of them were actually pretty good, Antoninus Pius. What happened, where the Christians fell foul, and the Christians were often called atheists, because the Romans actually were very open to religion. You could bring your religion, but you also had to participate in the public religion of emperor worship. And one of the ways you did that was by taking a pinch of incense and throwing it before the sort of altar of the emperor, because the emperor was considered divine. And as long as you did that, as long as you played the game, did your virtue signaling, we would say today, everything was okay. And a lot of them, you know, didn't even want to kill the Christians, but a lot of the envious people of the crowd, they would turn the Christians over. And when they asked them point blank, you know, are you a Christian? And if they refused to put that incense to the emperor, then they saw it as you know, socially disturbing, and then they would put them to death. But when you read the accounts, Melanie, most of the governors are good people who try to get these Christians off. The governor who tried Polycarp did not want him put to death. He's like, come on, buddy, just get with the program, okay? Go ahead and make the cake for the gay marriage. Let's put it that way, okay? Go ahead and pay obeisance to this secular religion, and then you can go back to your church and do whatever you want. But the Christians very boldly stood up and they said, no, we will not bow before Caesar. They obeyed Caesar, okay? Like I said, this was passive resistance. They paid their taxes. They were very, very good citizens. But they would not bow to the state religion because we are Christians. We worship Christ. We do not worship Caesar. And most of the accounts, you see Polycarp and others like Ignatius treating the governors and the leaders with respect. It's generally the crowds who are calling for blood. And just like happened with some of the witch trials, a lot of times there is a famine or some natural disaster, and the uneducated people want something to blame. So you blame the witches, you blame the Christians, you blame the landlords, whatever. A lot of it is that dynamic that we've seen throughout history. We particularly saw it during communism, China and Soviet Union, things like that. So we can recognize this sort of stuff. But again, what's amazing about Polycarp is even the guards that come to take him, he doesn't like yell at them and call them losers and bobo, you know, boo. He's like, he respects them. He just says, please, give me an hour to pray. And he ended up praying for two, pray for everybody right there. The guards were so moved by this. And there are lots of accounts, Melanie, where a Christian is martyred and the guards who were witnesses of it were so amazed by the faith and courage that they converted and then they were martyred themselves. So a lot of the witness to the reality of Christ was not just that people died for their faith, but the way they died, singing hymns, at peace with all people, unafraid. This was just amazing. And every time I read this, I say, look at that. They respected authority. Look, when Paul tells us to respect those in authority, right? That was when Nero was the emperor, okay? So we're supposed to respect authority, but we must bear witness to Christ and we must not bow to Caesar.
So Polycarp was in fact martyred, and while he was going to be martyred, he spoke some famous words. And what were they?
Oh my gosh. The guy's like James Bond with these cool lines. I mean, you can't make this up. I mean, and by the way, in my book, okay, we have an eyewitness account of the death of Polycarp. And what I did in my book to make it more sort of real is I just retold it in my own words as if I were that eyewitness, because we directly stuff. But some of the words that happened is, all right, The governor says, okay, come on, Polycarp, get with the program. Just say away with the atheists, because they considered the Christians atheists because they didn't believe in all the gods. And what Polycarp did in this really cool, manly moment is he turned to the crowd and he kind of rolled his hand across the crowd and he said, away with the atheists. Okay, so in other words, he's saying the real atheists are the pagans in the crowd. So that's just really cool. And then once again, the governor says, will you recant? And these beautiful words, Polycarp says, for 86 years I have served my Lord, and he has done me no wrong. How then can I blaspheme my King and my Savior? I mean, these words were engraved in the hearts of the early Christians. It gave them courage, right? A little bit later, again, please, will you recant and save your life? He says, I declare to you that I am a Christian. I am a Christian. I can't declare anything else. But look, if you want to learn more about the faith, let's set a time and a date, and I will tell you everything. And then the governor says, turn to the crowd now and preach to them. Now, you would think that Polycarp would take this opportunity to share the gospel. But he says something interesting. He basically says, my Lord teaches us not to cast pearls before swine. I respect you, governor, and I will sit down and tell you, but I will not throw that which is precious to people who will only laugh at it and ridicule it. Just a pretty amazing response. And one more response, again, that's kind of famous, is, again, the governor says, beware, Polycarp, or you will be thrown into the fire. And look at these wonderful words that ring out. We're talking about over 1,800 years later, almost 1,900 years. He says, the fire that you threaten me with, Lord Governor, is short-lived and can do me no eternal harm. After a time, the fire you set will go out and be as if it never was. But I would have you know that there is another kind of fire, the fire of judgment. That fire, my Lord, burns eternally and never goes out. That is the fire that awaits the souls of the ungodly. Let all of you take care. I mean, isn't this an amazing document, Melanie, passed down all these years?
Well, I think that just shows the boldness of a devoted Christian, because I think of, how would we say that if we were in a trial and about to be killed? And that's a question I have for you. You know, how did Polycarp's trial perhaps mirror the trial of Jesus and maybe also of Socrates?
See, now sometimes this may make us doubt some of the details, but I don't know. For instance, Eusebius or the eyewitness that Eusebius is quoting makes it clear that when Polycarp was taken to the arena, he was taken on a donkey, right? Which makes us think of, when Jesus comes into Palm Sunday, he comes in on a donkey. So there are certain elements that maybe they're changing it a little bit. Although, again, that's not so much a problem for people writing back then as it is for us. We've got this sort of logical, scientific, mathematical view of things why did God give us four gospels? God's all right at giving us four different perspectives of the same story. So part of it is our problem, living after the Enlightenment, and we think. But still, like Jesus, and you can see the eyewitness is making a connection as Polycarp gives his testimony before the governor there. It's like Jesus speaking before Pontius Pilate. And remember, Pontius Pilate made every effort to save Jesus, but in the end, he gave into the whims of the crowd. And that's very similar to what's going on with Polycarp and even to other martyrdom accounts. But I mentioned Socrates. A lot of people don't know this. Again, when I did my research and I read the early apologists, both the early martyrs and the early apologists like Justin Martyr, who of course was both, they constantly look back to Socrates as the first martyr for monotheism. Now, they knew that Socrates did not have access to the Old Testament, but they saw that the greatest of these virtuous pagans were moving, that clearly you can see Socrates, he doesn't know Yahweh, but he's moving towards an understanding that if there is a God, he must be a God who is all good and all powerful and is the standard of virtue, not like Zeus and Poseidon and Apollo who are sleeping around and doing all these crazy things. They're moving there. And particularly when Polycarp stands before the governor and the governor says, come on, give in or we're going to throw you to the lions. He says something that sounds like Socrates. He says, bring them on if you must, but it is not possible that I should exchange a good way of thinking for a bad. Rather, it is altogether right and proper that I should abandon the way of evil for the way of righteousness. And Socrates says similar things. I must follow virtue, not vice. Okay? And unfortunately, vice runs faster than virtue. And you've caught me now. But I am going to do that which is right. So it fascinates me because I also wrote a book called From Achilles to Christ and The Myth Made Fact. And I'd like to write and speak a lot, Melanie, about what we can learn from the higher pagans. And even the early martyrs saw somebody like Socrates as one who bore witness to the truth.
So I guess I should say trigger warning for anybody who doesn't like to hear these kinds of stories about Christians who were killed for their faith. But would you tell us what was the manner of Polycarp's martyrdom?
It is powerful. And I should say that when you read these accounts, you know, they're not there, frivolous, like watching some Saw movie or something, okay? They're just very faithful and honest to what happened. Now, the crowd was so angry at Polycarp. Again, you need to understand this, okay? Thank God we are not being martyred, okay? But we can understand the rage of the sort of modern, postmodern person when we say something like, a man is a man and a woman is a woman. We're just speaking simple truth and they like hate us. Now, thank God they're not killing us yet, okay? But you need to understand, it's very similar to that. The crowd is angry because here is someone standing for the truth unafraid and it gets them angry, right? Okay, so they're like, throw this guy to the lions, right? We want the most bloody and painful death possible. But guess what? The Romans are nothing but orderly. The part of the program with the wild animals, and they did kill many Christians with wild animals, was over. And so the Romans always followed the program. And so instead, he was to be burnt alive. And there's the prophecy of that burning pillow. So he comes forward and the eyewitness compares him to a sort of noble ram coming forward to be sacrificed, just like in the sacrifices of the Old Testament. And he comes forward, he makes this incredible prayer, Polycarp, where he says it is a privilege to him to share in the cup of Christ, right? And he calls upon the Holy Spirit. I mean, he's just unafraid. He's not cocky. He's just sure and unafraid. And as he comes forward and they tie him to the stake where they're going to burn him, it's kind of a cross, they're about to nail him to it. And he says, why are you nailing me to it? And he says, because people flinch when the fire comes. And Polycarp said, my Lord whom I serve will give me the strength. And so they did not nail him to it, just they tied him, and he did not flinch. And the eyewitness speaks of, as the flames raged, the flames surrounded him. So it looked like he was a man standing inside of a sail, a furled sail on a ship. Or again, he seemed like a loaf of bread baking in the fire. Or again, like gold in the fire, in the crucible. And yet the fire would not touch him. And a lot of times we have these miracles. Finally, one of the guards shoved a spear through the fire, long spear through the fire into Polycarp, and immediately blood came out and put out the fire. One account says a white dove flew out, and only then were they able to kill him. So the flames could not do it. It was the spear, a kind of spear in the side, if you think of Christ. And again, none of this is told for prurient reason. It's told to show the strength and faith that God gave to the martyrs.
So the Romans burned his body, and why did they do that? And then, you know, the Christians collected his bones, but what did they do with his bones?
All right. Again, and I forgot something, just because you mentioned before, Melanie, about East and West. Okay, I've got a Greek Orthodox background. The Lord put me in the evangelical. I kind of switched places with Hank. But it's very important. A lot of people always say, why are these Orthodox people, Greeks, Russians, Bulgarians, Egyptians, why are they so ethnocentric? And generally speaking, it's true. What we don't realize, we always hear about the martyrs in the West that died in Rome. But if you read any accounts, the martyrs in the East have always put up with more pain and more suffering. And that extends right on to the Muslim Empire and right on to the atheist empires of the communists. And there's a reason why the Orthodox people held together, because they have always been persecuted more fiercely than the Western Christians. And again, always the persecution was the worst in the edges of the empire, in the East, where things broke down. In the West, where there was more order, there was martyrdom, but there was less martyrdom. Now, again, the envy of the crowd hated Polycarp so much that they wouldn't even allow the Christians to take his body for proper burial. They burned it, and they were horrified, but they loved Polycarp so much that after the fire went out, they took the bones, and those bones became for them relics. Now, this is a little bit strange for evangelicals and Protestants, but for Orthodox and Catholics, relics are very important. Relics are like a bone from one of the saints or a piece of the cross. It's a physical object that links us to the past. And again, that's a little strange for evangelicals, but it's important. And for a lot of Orthodox and Catholic churches, if you want to really consecrate the altar, then in the altar cloth, you want some kind of relic that links you to the early church. Very, very important. And some historians think that what we call the cult of the saints begins right here with the bones of Polycarp. And the eyewitness tells us that every year afterwards, they would gather together to remember their beloved saints. And again, I know this sounds like voodoo or, kind of witchcraft, but it is, the body is important in Christianity. God created the body good. He created the soul good. They're both fallen, but they will both be redeemed. That's why Catholics and Protestants have given in, but Orthodox still insist in burial rather than cremation because of the high view of the body. And so these bones is their connection to the martyr and in some way their connection to Christ. To help an evangelical understand this, evangelicals want to go to the Holy Land and walk in the footsteps of Jesus. It's that kind of bodily connection. And this may be one of the beginnings of that right here in the martyrdom of Polycarp.
That's really interesting that you mentioned that background, because I still think, as we posited it at the beginning of this podcast, that a lot of things that the early church, and I'm not talking about the book of Acts, but the early church around the time of Polycarp, is just unknown, foreign. People don't understand this. And, they are true believers that we will see someday in eternity. So it's very helpful.
No, Melanie, just to add to that quickly, and again, one of the strangest things about Protestants is prayers to the saints, the idea of praying to the saints. And what's interesting is, yes, as Protestants, of course we believe that our dead in Christ are alive. In fact, they're more alive than we are. And yet we say that and we act like they're gone, right? In older church traditions, there's an understanding of the witness of the saints, that they are there around the throne room of God, as we see them in Revelation 4, and they are still interceding for us and for the church. So you're right. In the Eastern and Catholic tradition, there is a wider understanding of the body of Christ as very much including the dead in Christ, particularly the blessed martyrs like Polycarp.
So what can we learn today in the 21st century about the martyrdom of Polycarp? It just seems, again, so removed from our, religious experience, especially where religion today, especially in America, has been so defined by very, as I mentioned, pop evangelicalism with no liturgy whatsoever, just, singing a bunch of rock songs and maybe a brief message and just kind of a feel-good thing. And there's just a real lack of understanding some of these things that are so important, including liturgies, which are done in a lot of Protestant traditions. But I would say that's the minority, because I was looking at some surveys recently. It sounds like maybe 14 million people are just of the mega church evangelical That's the most of the people in the American who considers themselves Christians. And so I go to a Reformed Presbyterian church and we definitely have liturgies, but that would not be typical for the average quote unquote Christian in America. So what can we even learn from this guy?
It is just a sense of sacredness, a sense. See, when I was younger, Melanie, a lot of it was the success in life gospel, right? Become a Christian, you get a big car, beautiful wife, all that. That's still around today. But what I'm seeing more than that is what you might call Christianity as self-help. It's a return of the power of positive thinking by Norman Vincent Peale. And it is a therapeutic view of Christianity. God just wants me to make me happy and feel good. And the new idea of sacramentalism is having smoke fillers that fill the room with smoke when they're worshiping, right? That's the closest to their idea of the sublime or the transcendent or whatnot. But I mean, look, thank God we are not being martyred in our country right now. But look, right now, if you want to understand a little bit about martyrdom, are you willing to be embarrassed for your faith in Christ, right? I'm not talking about being killed, not even necessarily losing your job, though it could lead to that. But are you just willing to stand out and feel uncomfortable? I teach at a school that's very international, a lot of students from around the world. And I tell them the strange thing about Americans is that we are, at the same time, the most individualistic people who've ever lived. At the same time, we're the most conformist, Melanie. We have such cognitive dissonance if we stick out and people are looking at us and we want to fit in and virtue signal. It's really a weird thing about Americans. Are we willing to stand for the truth and even be willing to be laughed at? But again, we need to speak truth to power, but we need to do it in love. Polycarp and his other martyrs, they were willing to pray for their enemies, even as Jesus did, even as Stephen, the first martyr, did, prayed. They are willing, okay? We give testimony, but we still respect the government. Look, I'll just give an example here, Melly. I'm very conservative. I'm no fan of Joe Biden. But when they started doing that, what was that thing they used to say? That was basically a curse against Biden. It's like, you do not do that, okay? We are Christians and we respect those in authority. I disagree with Biden. I don't think he's very effective, but you don't curse out your leaders. This is not Christian. We need to treat the leadership with respect, but we also have to boldly testify. Let me give you another example. Okay, Polycarp does sometimes use pretty strong rhetoric, away with the atheists. And I think it's okay for us to use a little bit of parody, like the Babylon Bee, okay? But what I like about Polycarp is even though he can be sharp, with it, even as Jesus was often, woe to you Pharisees, whitewashed tombs. He doesn't give way to cynicism or bullying, right? So we can use our rhetorical power to speak truth to power. But let us not give way to cynicism and just give up and say, they're all corrupt, okay? Not everybody in the government is corrupt. We have to not give way to cynicism. We also need to remember, so importantly, that our true foe is Satan. Now, that doesn't mean demonize your enemy. It means you can love your enemy because you know that the real enemy is the devil. And again and again, in the martyrdom accounts, they realize that. And that makes them not demonize their enemy, but humanize their enemy and understand what the real fight is about. And finally, they witness to Christ, but they will not let the gospel be treated with contempt. There is sometimes when you don't speak precious things, if they will be trampled underfoot by the swine, who, by the way, will then turn and rend you to pieces. So that's something to learn and be sober about as well.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note, I have a fun question for Lou. It's the holiday season. Is there a particular tradition that your family does that you enjoy celebrating every year?
Wow. I just like singing the Christmas carols. Get out there and sing the Christmas carols. I play the piano. So let's gather around the piano and play and sing as long as we can. And that's something I just love to do.
Well, thanks, Lou, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on, Melanie, and blessings for Advent.
Christmas is coming up this weekend, so I want to say on behalf of the entire editorial staff at the Christian Research Journal, we wish you a very Merry Christmas to both you and your family. You've been listening to episode 319 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest, Dr. Louis Marcos, has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and his article is called The Martyrdom of Polycarp. Our subscribers can read his article for free at our website, equip.org, because every subscription comes with online access to those exclusive articles. But you can also head on over to equip.org to subscribe and receive access to read his article. So again, Merry Christmas from the editorial staff of the Christian Research Journal. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that. And every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.